This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're with Andrew McConnell Stott in LA, who has just won the National Marfield Award for Writing in the Arts, given by the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. Andrew, congratulations.
Thank you, Grace, and thank you for having me.
It is the only award in America for writing in the arts, comparable to the Pulitzer Prize, I think. It is a great honor. I believe it's the 14th year it's been awarded. I've seen it go to books in theater. I've seen it go to books in ballet, literature, history. And now, what is your book and what is the title?
So my book is called What Blessed Genius? The Jubilee That Made Shakespeare. And it's about an event that took place in September 1769, a three-day celebration of Shakespeare that's really responsible for placing him in the stratosphere as the world's greatest literary genius.
Well, it is the best book I have read this year. It is very, very funny. I believe you should be nominated for the William Thackeray Humor Award, actually.
Oh, really? That would be great.
Well, yes, you've won enough awards, but that it is very rare to have a scholarly book where you learn so much that is really so witty. I laughed out loud. Andrew, has anyone else agreed with me?
Well, I hope so. You know, I mean, it's such a humorous event in many ways. And even though perhaps from the outside, it can look to be a somewhat dry and historical topic.
Not at all.
Yeah, the people involved were so humorous. And, you know, the 18th century is just sort of filled with this vigor and humor that I really wanted to capture.
Yes, tell us why it was such a brilliant calamity.
So in 1769, the great actor and theatre manager David Garrick decided that he wanted to celebrate Shakespeare in the town of his birth, Stratford-upon-Avon in Staffordshire. And the town just really wasn't prepared for all of these Londoners just descending on them en masse. And Garrick himself had not really arranged that much. He'd arranged some songs and some dances and some balls, but it was a literary festival in which the celebrant really didn't appear at all. There was not a play by Shakespeare performed. There was not even a single scene of Shakespeare performed. Shakespeare existed only in the form of allusion and vague references to his work. And then to cap it all off, of course, you had the great English weather, and it just rained for 3 days straight, soaking absolutely everybody.
It would be as if we had put on the World Olympics and someone forgot to pave the road in.
Yeah, exactly.
It is, and as you say in the book, why in September of all things, why didn't Garrick think through that?
Well, you know, I guess sometimes it can be pleasant in September, but if he'd consulted the weather almanac, he would have seen for the past several years it had rained throughout September, so it's not great planning.
And tell us some of the principals who were involved, because you have some of the great characters of that century appearing here, and Samuel Johnson is mentioned. So tell us some of the great people who came through that day.
Well, David Garrick was such an important cultural presence in Britain during the 18th century. He'd come up as an actor, and he was the most skilled and realistic actor of his generation. He'd really changed the paradigms of acting and what was considered good acting during the course of his career. But by 1769, he was getting on a little, and he was really looking towards retirement. And so instead of being such a powerful performer, he was really pivoting towards being a cultural gatekeeper and a tastemaker for the country. And so he was extremely good at building powerful networks of influential people, whether they be rich people, literary people, aristocrats. And he had a real talent for kind of building those alliances and those communities and these kind of complex groups at which he was at the center. And so he knew everyone. And I think art and theater at that time, and literature as well, had a status that perhaps doesn't quite enjoy today. And so there were many, many people. Everybody who was everybody was in Garrick's orbit somehow. And Garrick was the most famous man, I think, except for the king himself.
Wow. And the king and queen often attended productions.
Of course, yeah, because they were the official patrons of the theatre in Britain at that time. There was only two royal theatres in London, Covent Garden and Drury Lane. Both had a patent from the Crown in order to allow them to operate. And as such, they were frequented by monarchy frequently because this is, you know, one of the things people do. There's a play every night, you have a dinner, you wander off to see the play.
And is it true that you only had to pay half price if you came in after the second act?
That's correct. So what would happen is that there would be a huge influx of people and halfway through the evening. And so these people would be paying half price, and often they would be there merely to socialize. So they're not too worried about following the play, not too worried about the plot or the performers. They've really, you know, they've done their early evening activities and now they're ready to sit in the theater and chat for the rest of the evening. It was a great disruption and a great annoyance to those members of the audience who'd come when the doors had opened initially, and to the actors themselves on stage. But what the playwrights did to adapt to this was they made sure that Act 3 began with a synopsis of the action so far.
Oh, that is wonderful. This is buildings fall down, there's flooding, there's a formal dance where people are wading in water. It is absolutely brilliant. Give us a little reading from this book. And first of all, I'll tell people who you are. Andrew McConnell Stott is the author of 4 books of nonfiction. He holds the Royal Society of Literature Jerwood Prize for Nonfiction, the Sheridan Morley Prize for Theater Biography, the George Freely Memorial Award, and was chosen a BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week. That's what we all dream of. Let's hear a bit from the book, please.
So this is right from the beginning, just as the plans to put a Jubilee on in Stratford-upon-Avon are in their very, very, very early stage. So, on May the 3rd, 1769, George Keate and Francis Wheeler emerged from the vegetal shade of Covent Garden Market and strode the 20 paces down to David Garrick's house at 27 Southampton Street. Stiff with reverence for the object they bore before them, they made an unlikely pair. Keate, a camel-faced minor poet, who in the course of many years abroad had become close friends with Voltaire, the genius of French literature, was now enjoying a leisurely life, thanks to a substantial portfolio of Whitechapel properties that afforded him the time to write delicate volumes of verse that he doted on like children. Wheeler, by contrast, worked for a living, serving as the steward of the Court of Records for the borough of Stratford in Warwickshire, the reward for which was a modest £10 a year. Garrick greeted his guests with characteristic good grace, despite having only recently risen from what he described as the bed of death, fighting off a combined assault of fever, gout, jaundice, and stones. Illness lowered him often, the result of being born with only a single kidney, and even more so now that he had entered his 50s. It was following a bout of sickness that he'd first made Keats' acquaintance while convalescing in Bath. Garrick's skin was yellow then, and shaking and puking between curative dips, he'd found that Keats' drowsy, convivial manner and unusual face, he had no eyelashes or eyebrows, lifted his spirits. The two men had been on good terms ever since, which is why Wheeler had asked Keate to come along. Being in the London home of the world's most famous actor was an unsettling experience for this provincial man, and he mirrored his host's cautious, recuperative movements in his own uncertain bearing. On the walls hung views of Garrick's Hampton Villa, with his classically inspired Temple to Shakespeare, where Garrick, his wife, the Austrian dancer Eva Maria, and their spaniel Biddy, presided over a span of the Thames, fat and prosperous and fringed with lithe willows.
So there's the backdrop, Andrew McConnell Stott's award-winning book. Where did you get the germ of this idea? I know this is your era, you've written other books, but it's such a niche in Shakespearean history. What triggered this? What happened to you? When did you decide, I've got to get a hold of this?
So I'm always very interested in the connection between art and commerce, and I really like to write sort of capsule biographies about groups. So this has it all for me, you know, and also, you know, I'm very attracted, maybe it's my British background, to bathos and disaster. So the triumphant failure. I'm kind of a big fan of that. So all those things kind of come together for me, and I wrote a book a while ago now, nearly 10 years, about the pantomime performer Joseph Grimaldi. And David Garrick had worked closely with Grimaldi's father, who was a horror of a human being, a real nightmare. And Garrick had complained about him a lot. And I just kind of like those theatrical groups, you know, those ideas of talented and petulant people sort of rubbing each other up the wrong way and having fits and falling out. And as in all things 18th century, failing to plan with any foresight whatsoever. So, I'm a big fan of Shakespeare, and it's very difficult to find something new to say about Shakespeare. So this was a way of kind of going in that direction without tackling it head on.
That is the astonishing thing. You found something new about Shakespeare. Where did you find the primary sources? I think you had to read every newspaper published in September of 1769, and there were a lot of them.
Yeah, there was. It's remarkable, actually, how vibrant the press was back in the 18th century and how many different titles there were, both in terms of national newspapers, but also provincial ones. So every region had its newspaper, but not only its newspaper, but also its magazines filled with politics and culture. It really was a very rich textual, literary, cultural life. And so, you know, as a researcher, I benefited from that greatly because...
Where did you find them? Where were these newspapers?
So, I mean, fortunately, being a member of a university, I find them digitized through various resources that have been put online in the past 10 years or so. I mean, this would have been something as a younger researcher, I would have probably been in the British Library. But now I can do it from my Southern California home. Well, I don't want to completely disappoint you, Grace, because I did spend some time in the libraries of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust in Stratford-upon-Avon, looking at the primary sources there. So they have very rich collections to do with the establishment of the town hall in Stratford-upon-Avon, the building of which was really the very initial germ for the Jubilee in 1769, and a lot of documents, diaries and letters pertaining to the Jubilee itself, and some of the merchandise that you could buy at the Jubilee, including rosettes and handkerchiefs and all these kind of wonderful things made out of mulberry wood. So I did do some rummaging in the archives, and so I think I get my primary source badge from that.
Plowing through old dusty yellow pages.
It's kind of told from dual perspectives. So David Garrick has a chapter, and then James Boswell, obviously the famous biographer of Samuel Johnson, has a chapter, and they take it in turns, because I really wanted to kind of get the sort of dual perspective on the event. One view from, you know, the man who organized it and the man who was looking to lionize Shakespeare and really to elevate him to the status of a transcendent literary god. And then from the perspective of somebody very clubbable, and, you know, Boswell is always extremely amiable company. He's one of the most amiable people in world literature, just because he's so fallible and so human and so transparent about his inner life. And, you know, he goes along for a laugh, essentially, and to look at pretty girls and to be noticed and to have things, flattering things written about himself in the press to puff up his ego. And so, you know, in many ways, Garrick is the cultural machine, and we see all that energy devoted into that. And then Boswell is the consumer. He's the other side. You know, why do you go to one of these things? Well, you partly go because you love Shakespeare and you want to celebrate the memory of Shakespeare, but you go for a host of other reasons as well, which is to do with leisure and, you know, with entertainment and with, you know, flirtation and all these, and drinking. So, having a good time.
We must, I tell you this, it has to be a movie.
I'd love it.
I mean that. It has to be a movie. It would be the most rollicking, hilarious. It would be a learning experience, but it is really, really high holiday. So wonderful. So read us a bit more. This is the highly competitive Marfield Award. And the thing I love about this, Andrew, is that this award is given to bring literature and the arts down off Mount Olympus. This award is chosen for a book that would please the general public. And I think that is really special. So read us a bit.
So this is a passage that describes Stratford-upon-Avon, which many listeners may have visited as tourists, but which in 1769 was very much a provincial little hamlet that did nothing really to honour the memory of Shakespeare. So situated in the gentle hills beside the banks of the River Avon, which in 1769 was a tiny hamlet that did very, very little to honour the memory of Shakespeare. So, situated in gentle hills beside the banks of the River Avon, Stratford-upon-Avon was a compact municipality of 12 streets and 400 half-timbered houses, sheltering 2,000 souls. Its size and character had changed little in the 200 years since Shakespeare had walked reluctantly from his home at Henley Street to take his place on the school's narrow benches, just as the open fields that lay beyond remained largely unaltered since the once mighty Forest of Arden had been cleared away by Anglo-Saxon handsaws. Its sovereign smells were lanolin and fresh air, its loudest sound the knelling of Holy Trinity's bells. Stratford rarely made the news, and prior to the arrival of Garrick, its most recent appearance in the London papers was the report of a man who, walking home to Birmingham, had saved a baby owl lying in the road, only to be attacked by its mother with such violence as to deprive him of the sight of one eye, according to the newspaper report. Neither had it done much to exploit its connection to Shakespeare. The house in which he had been raised, for example, had been altered many times, with new rooms and extra kitchens, and the greater part of it being converted into an inn called the Maidenhead. Catering to visitors was not a priority, a fact that had dismayed the writer Horace Walpole, who passed through in 1751 and declared it the wretchedest old town I ever saw, which I intended for Shakespeare's sake to find snug and pretty and antique, not old. The most extreme example of indifference, however, had been displayed by the Reverend Francis Gastrell, the vicar of Frobisham in Cheshire, who had retired to Stratford and purchased New Place with its 10 fireplaces, 5 gables, 2 orchards, 2 barns and 2 gardens, one of which contained a famous mulberry tree planted by Shakespeare himself around 1609, after King James I had thousands of the trees imported from France. Although slow growing, in the course of the intervening 1.5 centuries, the mulberry had become a thick and intervolving town landmark, attracting occasional tourists like David Garrick, who would come up from London to stand beneath it while contemplating Shakespeare's genius, helping themselves in summer to commemorative sprigs and branches and staining their lips in autumn with its wine-dark fruit. These intrusions so aggrieved Gastrell that, in 1756, he hired the carpenter John Onge to fell the tree and dismember it for firewood, so angering the townsfolk that they in turn formed an avenging mob who descended on New Place and broke all its windows. This did nothing to alter the Reverend's strong conviction that he could do whatever he wanted with his own property, irrespective of who had lived there before. 3 years later, when faced with a bill for the monthly assessments towards the maintenance of the parish poor, he refused to pay on account of the fact that he spent a large part of the year residing in Lichfield. When the Corporation of Stratford insisted, Gastrell vowed that his house would never be assessed again and had the entire building demolished, leaving a fresh stump and an exposed foundation as all that remained of William Shakespeare's estate.
Oh, this is a marvelous background. You said you were interested in commerce, and the commercial aspects of this jubilee are really where the details are. Tell us about the man who was charged for asking the time of day. I mean, they were price gouging, right? I mean, there's not enough food for everyone, not enough bedding for everyone, and someone actually charged one of the visitors for asking the time of day.
That's right. I think the locals fell into two camps. Those who were deeply suspicious of the Londoners and all of the visitors from out of town and wanted nothing to do with them, and those who saw this as a wonderful example to cash in and make money from the gullibility and really the fact that these people were stranded with no food and lodging to make as much money as they possibly could. So yes, there's a story in which one man asks the time and is charged in advance, and then he's told the hour and he says, well, what are the minutes? And he says, well, you'll have to pay me again for me to tell you what the minutes are. And there are stories of people listening in there are stories of people sleeping in hay barns and in outhouses and in carriages, and being served these really miserable dinners of pigeon and all these other inedible foods.
Is it true that they ate a 350-pound turtle?
Yes. So one of the events was a supper. Of course, this had nothing to do with Shakespeare whatsoever. But, 18th century townspeople liked their ceremonial suppers. And the dish, the central dish, was a turtle fresh from the Caribbean. And, apparently you can cook a turtle. One turtle can serve several different dishes, which you make out of the various different components. And this was considered to be a great and rare delicacy.
Oh, this is just a book of details. It is the details that are so delicious. Now, that mulberry tree that we spoke about that was in Shakespeare's yard was... apparently there were more items made out of mulberry than that tree could have possibly served.
Yes, I think this is one of the ways in which the opportunists who saw the gullible Londoners coming maximized their income.
Well, Andrew McConnell Stott and his award-winning book, What Blessed Genius, The Jubilee That Made Shakespeare. As I say, the details are just so precious. Now, did the bell ringers get 12 shillings?
Something like that, yeah. So, the accounts are in the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. A lot of these sort of payments, and Garrick, as a manager of the theatre, was not just, an artist with all the stereotypical connotations that come with that of a sort of bohemian lifestyle. He was a meticulous bookkeeper, had a really good business mind, was more like a kind of a Hollywood producer in many ways, with a kind of a nose for a hit and how to make a show and put it together and get a success from it. So, he had his misses too, of course, but he was very, very shrewd with money. Didn't want to spend more than he had to on anything, always wanted to make a deal, and then kept meticulous accounts.
Oh, the money part is the silver thread of humor that goes throughout this book, and it is wonderful to follow. Why do you think the judges chose your book, Andrew?
That's
a good question, isn't it?
That's a fantastic question. And I was honored to be on the shortlist and genuinely surprised with, no false modesty at all to be selected as the winner. I really was humbled by that, because the other writers and the other books on the shortlist were really exceptional. And so it was a real surprise, and especially at this moment with everything everybody's going through, to receive some good news like that was just wonderful. I'm very, very grateful. And I wrote a book that I hope was accessible, jaunty, moved mm-hmm. along, and wasn't too long.
It wasn't too long. I think they chose it because there is nothing like it I have ever read. It is so original and so fresh. And you even hark back to reminding us how Shakespeare's plays were revised and written over. It's a miracle anything survived. And before we hear the final reading, tell me, how did you find out about James Boswell's sex life?
So James Boswell wrote down absolutely everything about his sex life. So in the 60s, Boswell's papers, his diaries, his journals, his letters were purchased by Yale, by the Beinecke Library in Yale. and a number of scholars went around meticulously editing them. So they've been published in a series of volumes over the years, and they're very accessible. And this is why Boswell is such a remarkable person, because, you know, he tried to follow the Rousseauian ideal of knowing oneself. I know that's not a quote from Rousseau, but, you know, this idea of exploring one's interior life and being honest with oneself and taking the information you find there and trying to use it as a foundation for self-improvement. And I think he really took that to heart. Plus, he was a compulsive writer, wrote everything in so many different genres. And if he'd have focused on a single genre and maybe put all of his talents in that direction, he could have been one of the literary greats.
And I am going to tell everyone I know they cannot borrow my copy. They have to buy their own. So let's hear a little bit in closing, Andrew Stott.
So David Garrick is about to address all of the people who have come to the Jubilee in what he's calling his Ode to Shakespeare, which is the sort of signature performance, the capstone performance at the end of this three-day event. Close to 1,000 people awaited him inside the amphitheatre. The space was beautiful in spite of the torrent of rain outside, hung with crimson curtains and lit with 800 lights which reflected off the gilding on the cornices and pilasters. Some slight adjustments had to be made now that Garrick wouldn't be entering at the head of a pageant, so instead he made his way alone to the front of the rostrum that enclosed the orchestra in a crescent of balusters, and sat looking over the audience as they continued to settle in. Behind him sat the entire orchestra and chorus of Drury Lane, more than 100 performers banked in a semicircle. Thomas Arne, dressed in a brown velvet suit, stood to one side, while behind the musicians, in pride of place at the orchestra's highest point, stood John Cheer's statue of Shakespeare, commissioned for the town hall's empty nook. Garrick looked nervous as the overture began. Some even said confused or intimidated. He stood and, giving a respectful bow that was received with warm applause, began. "To what blessed genius of the Isle," he asked his audience, "shall gratitude her tribute pay?" Before presenting them with a verbal image of Shakespeare, that demigod, attended by fey spirits and literary godkins. "Who Avon's flowery margin trod, while sportive fancy round him flew, when nature led him by the hand, instructed him in all she knew, and gave him absolute command, 'Tis he, the god of our idolatry.'" This last line, paraphrasing Juliet's "swear by thy gracious self, which is the god of my idolatry" from Romeo and Juliet, was one that Garrick had been using for years, adopting it as a motto for his own Shakespeare mania. However, given the worship of the mulberry tree and the deep ritualistic reverence he was attempting to convey, opening the ode with such an admission made some listeners uncomfortable. "Pious ears were offended by the boldness of the expression," remarked Lloyd's Evening Post, and others took occasion to compare the whole to the canonization of a Romish saint. Certainly, it was as if addressing a holy relic that Garrick turned at this point to the statue. "To him the song, the edifice we raise," he continued. "He merits all our wonder, all our praise."
The voice of Andrew McConnell Stott.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me on. I really, really enjoyed it.
The book is What Blessed Genius. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on Remote. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.